Blog Talk Radio.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox with your host, Kel Fritzy. I hope you are enjoying this beautiful day that we're having. It's absolutely wonderful weather out there. Been in the garden, got a little sun, but enough about me. Now, there are a few things I really need to discuss with you today, and quite frankly, to be honest, I have some things here I had no idea that I would be bringing up this evening. Of course, I am bringing up the issue of the Canadian government and their missive regarding Islam. That is fascinating. But there are a few other gems that I had come across today that I hope that you will find as equally fascinating as I did. We'll get into that a little bit later. I have a few clips I want to share with you. We'll get into those a little later. But right now, let's delve into the issue at hand. I really want to get to this. This is very, very interesting what the Canadian government is doing. This was issued this week. This is from the official desk of the federal conservative Canadian government. They're getting hard on Islam, boy. I'm telling you. They are proclaiming a new law that would ban promoting terrorism, violence, or criminal activity. Okay, every Western country is doing that. But just bear with me. It gets really interesting. A foreign national who makes public statements or uses any means to broadcast, write, produce, publish, or distribute material, including a website and public speaking, to express such views which, A, promote or glorify terrorism, violence, B, promote or glorify a listed entity under regulations establishing a list of entities pursuant to the Criminal Code of Canada, regulations implementing the United Nations resolutions on the suppression of terrorism, or the United Nations Al-Qaeda and Taliban regulations. C. Counsel, encourage, or incite others to commit terrorist activity or terrorist violence. D. Incite hatred that is likely to lead to violence against a specific group. And E, promote, counsel, encourage, or incite serious criminal activity. Now, I find this, like I say, fascinating because I have never seen Canada, the Canadian government, crack down so hard on Islam. They've pretty much covered everything here. Now, this is restricted to foreign nationals, and of course, that would mean their immediate deportation after sentencing, if such is warranted. But, of course, this also includes all of us, Canadian citizens. We could face very serious jail time if we engage in any of these activities. You know, you see these rallies going on all the time in cities all over the West. We see them. In Toronto in particular, we have issues with Al-Quds. We have issues with Islamic rallies in our square all the time. This new law would make it much harder for these groups to hold up their placards and glorify known terrorists. So these little parties might be liable for a shutdown, which means they may not be eligible for a permit to carry on these public displays. We all know that Islam is a political ideology, and it does promote, through the Quran and prophetic tradition, the glorification of terrorists, terrorist violence, and it counsels, encourages, and or incites others to commit terrorist activity or terrorist violence. We have the jihad, and that, of course, is the ultimate incitement of hatred and violence. Just sticking with the jihad issue, jihad is a violent, kinetic movement. If you have an Islamist tell you that jihad is a personal struggle, laugh in his face, then walk away. Because jihad is the central Islamic doctrine of holy war against non-Muslims, which will be in force until all of them are converted to Islam or enslaved or annihilated. Do you know that 9% of Quranic verses, 24% of them revealed in Medina, exhort to jihadi violence, while some 21 of the Sahih Bukhari hadiths and 67 rather, of the Sirah texts deal with the Prophet Muhammad's jihad. That's a whole lot of jihad in that slim, evil, green book. Exhorting Islamic holy war or jihad for forced conversion, enslavement, or annihilation of people just because they follow Christian, Jewish, polytheistic, or other non-Islamic religions is the worst kind of incitement of hatred and violence. Acting on jihadi excitement of hatred and violence, Muslim holy warriors have murdered some 270 million people during the past 1,400 years. Since the September 1st, 2011, jihad attacks in America, there have been over 20,000 violent attacks by jihadi groups across the world. Prophet Muhammad, he was the first jihadi Muslim commander to apply the doctrine of jihad to kill innocent infidels. He massacred 600 to 900 Jews of the Banu Qurayzah tribe in 1627 AD and put hundreds to death in his attack of the Banu Mustalik in 627 AD and settlement of Khyber 628 AD. Prophet Muhammad himself is on the record to claim his violent activities. Allah's apostate said, "I have been made victorious with terror." That is Bukhari 485.2-220. Islam is the worst amongst ideologies. It spews hatred and violence against others. It is the worst that humankind has known. It is far worse than Nazism or white supremacism or any other ideologies because it sanctifies its hatred and violence with the blessings of God. If anything, it deserves a ban under the new Canadian law. It must be the religion of Islam that deserves that ban, or at the very least, its holy scriptures, the Quran, Hadith, and Sirah. Now, here, I also have a sampling of the incitement of hatred and violence in the Quran that will put the Islam's holy book under the guillotine under the new Canadian law. Now, these are passages from the Quran that the Canadian law would insist on being quashed. Murder them and treat them harshly. Quran 9-123. Instill terror into the hearts of the unbelievers. Smite above their necks and smite all their fingertips off them. Quran 8.12-8.60. Kill the disbelievers wherever we find them. Quran 2.191. Fight and slay the pagans, seize them, beleaguer them, and lie in wait for them in every stratagem. For them, the unbelievers, garments of fire shall be cut, and there shall be poured over their heads boiling water, whereby whatever is in their bowels and skin shall be dissolved, and they will be punished with hooked iron rods. Quran 22-19-22. Allah wished to confirm the truth by his words, wipe the infidels, or non-Muslims, out to the last. Quran 8.7. Strike off the heads of the disbelievers, and after making a wider slaughter among them, carefully tie up the remaining captives. That is Quran 47-4. And finally, the punishment for those who wage war against Allah and His Prophet and make mischief in the land is to murder them, crucify them, or cut off a hand and foot on opposite sides. Their doom is dreadful. They will not escape the fire, suffering constantly. And that is a passage from the Quran 5-33. There are so many numerous other verses in this little green hate book that incite hatred, violence, genocide. It encompasses their entire lives, from their daily prayers to every other ritual. There is an inherent hatred of infidels that demonize them or call for terrorizing and murdering them. Islam, of course, we know is absolutely unremittingly anti-woman, anti-Semitic, and anti-homosexual. As far as anti-Semitism is concerned, Islam succeeded in what Hitler failed to achieve. Muhammad has made Medina free of the Jews. Muslims subsequently, they succeeded in dissoluting the entire Muslim world of the Jews. I'm telling you, it's a religion that has housed the largest portion of the world Jewry. 70 to 80% at the time of Islam's birth, Islam thrived, or Judaism, rather, thrived. Islam has pretty much done a wonderful job of wiping them out. Look what they did in Medina. They are succeeding in trying to desolate the entire Judea world. In everyday life, we know that Islam is a direct threat to the peace and security of the Canadian people, to its democracy and freedom. So if the Canadian government wants to enforce its new laws, it's crystal clear what will have to be its first target, guys. But we're not sure if this is going to happen. Because the real intent of this law is to promote Islam by targeting those who speak up against hatred and violence of Islam as the purveyors of hate speech, thus denying them entry into Canada. And that's a two-edged sword that we're going to be dealing with. I like this law. It's a good law. I hope it's enforced. However, I also hope that it is used wisely and responsibly, because if it is not, it can be used against us who decry the evil of Islam. We saw what happened to Pamela Geller. She was pushed out of the United Kingdom because she wanted to speak the truth about Islam. The very laws that denigrate Islam were used against her. Now, this new law, it's a good one, but it has to be very, very carefully practiced. We cannot allow it to be used against us. Pamela Geller, she also tried to, she didn't try, she succeeded. There were Islamic clerics trying to keep her out of Canada to speak in Toronto. However, Canada told the clerics to take a hike. Pamela Geller was allowed to speak in Canada on May 13th. She wasn't so lucky in the United Kingdom, who sent her a letter saying that she may incite violence. She might work up the population. So this is what I mean. Some of these laws, they have a double-edged sword. But like I say, Canada seems to have this one much more clear-cut, but let's hope that it is a good law for us. I was discussing this with a friend of mine, Belle, and I was saying, you know, I'm pretty thrilled about this. And I said, do you really think Canada is the first country in the West to disband Islam? And she said that, well, you know, I don't know. I think China and Japan might be on to, have been on to something for years before Canada. So that got me to thinking. So I decided to look into it a little more. And I concentrated on Japan more than anything because there was absolutely much more information. I'm not having so much luck with China, but Japan I did. But I also remember I have a friend who lived in Japan for 2 years, and she is an Islamic scholar, and we know her. Well, she's my friend Bonnie. Everybody, we know her as Bare Naked Islam. And I remember her telling me that, yeah, she lived in Japan. This was going back quite a few years. So I emailed her, and I said, hey, Bonnie, like, I'm trying to do this story here. What do you think? So she sent me an old link that she had posted in her blog, and this is from September 21st of 2012. There is, I don't know if it still is, but at the time, there was something circulating on the interweb, and it was regarding Islam in Japan. So Bonnie decided to address it. Like I say, she lived in Japan for 2 years. She attended university, and she also taught English. So I'm just going to relay to you what she shared in this article. Like I say, there was this popular email going around that reveals how difficult the Japanese make it for Islam to take hold in Japan. But she has, like I say, personal insight. This woman, I swear she never sleeps. Now, I'm going to read verbatim for you. It's not very long, but I want to read it verbatim for you. Now, I'm going to read the bullet points of this email that had been circulated. It is titled, Did You Know? Have you ever read the newspaper that a political leader or prime minister from an Islamic nation has visited Japan? And Bonnie is hard to believe. Indonesia's prime minister seems likely to have visited Japan. Japan, a country keeping Islam at bay, Japan has put strict restrictions on Islam and all Muslims. Bonnie's response, Japan puts strict restrictions on all foreigners, period. The reasons. Japan is the only nation that does not give citizenship to Muslims. Bonnie's response. Japan makes it exceedingly difficult, if not nearly impossible, for any foreigner, Muslim or otherwise, to become a citizen. In Japan, permanent residency is not given to Muslims. Bonnie. Rarely, if ever, given to any other foreigner either. There is a strong ban on the propagation of Islam in Japan. Nothing that Bonnie could find. In the University of Japan, Arabic or any Islamic language is not taught, in which Bonnie says there is no University of Japan, but there are many universities in Japan, one of which I attended. Back then, Arabic was not taught at Waseda University, but I doubt that that is the case today in every university. One cannot import Quran published in Arabic language. Bonnie says that is false. According to data published by Japanese government, it has given temporary residence to only 2 lakh Muslims who need to follow the Japanese law of the land. These Muslims should speak Japanese and carry their religious rituals in their homes, in which Bonnie replies. It is reported that there are some 10,000-plus Muslims in Japan. Many are workers from Indonesia who have work visas, and others are Japanese converts to Islam. Yes, all must follow Japanese law. Japan is the only country in the world that has a negligible number of embassies of Islamic countries, in which Bonnie says that's absolutely not true, and she has a list of Japanese foreign ministries from the Japan Ministry of Foreign Affairs with their list of their embassies in Islamic countries. Japanese people are not attracted to Islam at all. Wrong, considering there are many Japanese converts to Islam. And I'm nearly done here, guys. Muslims residing in Japan are the employees of foreign companies, in which Bonnie replies, many are, but not all. Even today, visas are not granted to Muslim doctors, engineers, or managers sent by foreign companies. Bonnie, as stated before, working visas are hard to come by in Japan, but I am sure some have been issued to professionals listed above. In the majority of companies, it is stated that in their regulations that no Muslim should apply for a job, in which Bonnie says that's another point she finds hard to believe. There's a lot in here. Like I say, this missive that had been circulating around the internet, Bonnie puts a lot of it, she debunks a lot of it. You got to be very careful about what you find on the internet. I have been duped way more than my share, believe me. This is why I have learned the hard way sometimes that you have to cross-reference absolutely everything. Everything. You have to cross-reference it upside down, sideways, 6 days to Sunday. This is why I'm glad that I have friends who actually had the experience. For example, in this case, discussing Japan. And that would be with my friend Bonnie. I'm glad I went to her. The Japanese government is of the opinion that Muslims are fundamentalist, and even in the era of globalization, they are not willing to change their Muslim laws. And Bonnie says, Japan changes its laws for no one, Muslim or otherwise. All must obey Japanese law. Muslims cannot even think about getting a rented house in Japan. Bonnie, that's preposterous. If anyone comes to know that his neighbor is a Muslim, then the whole neighborhood stays alert. And Bonnie has no idea how they came up with that information, because the Japanese as a whole are very welcoming and friendly to foreigners living there. No one can start an Islamic cell or Arabic madrasa in Japan. Well, there are several mosques in Japan. There is no personal Sharia in Japan. That one is true. If a Japanese woman marries a Muslim, then she is considered an outcast. But in Japanese society and in culture, in many Japanese families, a woman is an outcast for marrying any non-Japanese. So I just thought I would bring you some of the bullet points about that. I found it rather interesting. Just like to make things a little on the clear side if I can. But anyway, just getting back, though, to this article from the Canadian government. There are some in here who think that it may not work because, like I say, it's an all-encompassing law. Who knows what this law will entail? Who knows how it will be promoted? Who knows how it will be used? But as far as I'm concerned, it is a good start, because we have to start somewhere with Islam. You guys know, listening to me, how I feel about Islam and my approach to combating Islam. I don't want to get kinetically involved in battle. Nobody does. But I'm willing to, if it comes down to that, because I will be given no other choice, won't I? Right now, though, we have the capability to think with our minds. two things I always espouse. Ban the Quran is hate literature. And see Sharia law as a criminal activity. Ban the Quran, ban Sharia law. Two major dents in the armor we can make. Now, of course, Sharia law is banned in most Western countries, but we have seen what has happened in the United Kingdom when they allowed Sharia family courts, haven't we? That was the camel whose nose got through the tent. There are around 100 Sharia courts in the UK right now. Ban Sharia insists that its dictates be banned within Islam itself. Ban the Quran. It is hate literature. You listened to me. You heard what I said. I recited some of their defined sanctions. And this is only pertaining to murder. I read you 7 points on it. This is right out of the Quran. It is hate literature. That's all it is. That's all it will ever be. I do not see any reformation in Islam within my lifetime, and certainly not my grandchildren's, unless we start doing something about it now, and we have to get rid of these front groups. We have to get rid of the Council of American Islamic Relations, the Islamic Society of North America, the Muslim Student Associations. We have to break up these front groups for terrorism. Because that's what they are. They're just front groups for terrorism. But they are growing more powerful. Now, I'm going to say something, and you are going to think I'm going to be very, very harsh. There's something else I'd like to see happen, and that is to curtail Muslims in the higher political offices. Because there are people getting into the higher echelons that are creating real problems. Look at what Eric Holder is doing. Keith Ellison. Keith Ellison, the first politician in the United States to be sworn into office using a Quran. And they are in cahoots with the front groups like CARE. CARE in particular. If we can think with our heads and get around them, following some, it sounds simple, but it's going to be very, very hard and complicated and very, very long. But there's more of us than them as a collective. I think it could be done. Now, I do have something here. I'm going to take a break in a minute. I'm looking for something in my drop-down menu, and trust me, not to be able to find it. That's always my case. So what I'm going to do, I was going to save this for later. I'm completely switching gears in a minute, but I came... this was on Facebook. I just had to put it in my drop-down menu. This is hilarious, actually. This has nothing to do with Islam. This is just a little bit of Friday night humor. There is a woman who is concerned about the deer and the deer signs. Now, she called into a radio station last year. She called into Y94 Playhouse Fargo in... where was it? I believe it was in the New England. That was Fargo, North Dakota. My apologies, giving my head a shake. She's very concerned about the deer crossing signs, and she wants something done about it. So she phoned into, like I say, this radio station to voice her concerns about the deer signs. Take a listen.
Now, Donna, you got quite the vent today. It sounds like what's going on with you.
Well, I wanted to voice my opinion on something that's been bothering me for a really long time.
Okay.
I tried writing the newspaper and contacting TV stations, but nobody seems to want to stay with this. So that's why I'm calling you guys. Okay.
What's the issue?
Well, over the past few years, I've been involved in 3 separate car accidents involving deer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the population and everything. Each of these incidents, they've occurred shortly after I saw a deer crossing sign on the highway. Well, my frustration is that Minnesota and North Dakota Departments of Transportation would allow these deer crossings to be in such high traffic areas. I mean, I've even seen them on the interstate. Why are we encouraging deer to cross at the interstate? I don't get it. That's such a high traffic area. I mean,
you know,
I understand that deer are wild animals. They need to travel across the streets occasionally to survive. And of course, there's no food. But it seems to me that it's so irresponsible of us to allow these deer crossings to be in areas where these deer are so likely to be struck by oncoming traffic. I mean, wouldn't you agree? You think they would put deer crossings maybe, you know, in, you know, smaller towns, maybe during at a school crossing. It would be a safer place for them to cross.
Wait.
You know, put the deer crossing sign.
You know, deer crossings aren't telling deer that it's safe to cross there. It's just more of like an alert for drivers so they know it's like a high deer population.
The government put the deer crossings there. They can direct the deer population anywhere they want to by moving that deer crossing sign. I mean, you know, why in the world would they place it on the highway or the interstate, you know? I mean, God, there are so many other places I can think of than putting the deer crossing signs on busy highways or interstates.
You seem to be under the misunderstanding that the deer are somehow attracted to the deer crossing sign.
Well, yeah, the deer crossing sign is there to allow the deer to know that's where they need to cross.
Right. And all these car accidents you had involved a deer after you saw a deer crossing sign.
Exactly. I mean, I'm trying to watch out for the deer, but, I mean, you know, speed limit's 55, how am I supposed to, you know, you can't brake really quick if, you know, the deer just is crossing in that deer crossing area.
So you'd like to see these signs move somewhere safer?
Right, if we can move them, like, don't put deer crossing signs on the interstate or freeways. You know, put them in lower traffic areas. You know, somewhere where the speed limit's, you know, a lot slower, you know, maybe small towns, I don't know. I think school crossings is a good idea.
Well, listen, we will, you say you've tried to contact quite a few people about this.
Right, yeah, I wrote, like, at least 3 or 4 letters, and...
Spread the word, okay? We will try to kind of help you raise some awareness for this issue, okay?
Oh, thank you. We need to move those deer crossing signs.
We appreciate your comment this morning.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
And that was Donna, the concerned deer crossing lady. Well, derpy, derpy, derpity, derp, I am telling you. And she was serious. Donna, the concerned deer crossing lady. Well, I'm telling you, I'm not immune to my own blonde moments. Don't want to tease poor, you know, poor Donna there. I mean, she just wants to look out for the deer. She's worried about the deer, and, you know, we shouldn't be putting those signs there encouraging them to cross on the busy freeways. So her heart is in the right place. God bless you, Donna. I came across this article today, and this is from Sultan Nish, a.k.a. Daniel Greenfield. He wrote this fantastic article today. I want to share some of it with you. It's really, really good. And it's entitled, Muslims Are Not a Minority. Really salient points, as usual, Mr. Greenfield brings up. Well, this man never comes to the table empty-handed. His article starts off as, the most persistent myth of the Western Dhimmi narrative is that Muslims are a minority and must receive special protection and accommodation. But Muslims are not a minority. There are 1.5 billion Sunni Muslims worldwide, outweighing Catholics as the next largest religious faction at 1.1 billion and Hindus at 1 billion. They are still a minority in the overall population in Western countries, but a demographically trending majority. In the UK, more people attend mosques than the Church of England, and that makes Muslims the largest functioning religious group there. Mohammed was the most popular baby name last year, ahead of Jack and Harry. In France, in this generation, more mosques have been built than Catholic churches, and in southern France, there are already more mosques than churches. Mohammed Amin is the most popular double name, ahead of Jean-Baptiste, Pierre-Louis, Leopold, and Mohammed Ali. In Belgium, 50% of newborns are Muslim, and empty Belgium churches are being turned into mosques. The most popular baby name is Mohammed, and all of the top 7 baby names, 6 were Muslim. A quarter of Amsterdam, Marseille, and Rotterdam, and a fifth of Stockholm is already Muslim. I'm telling you, the most popular baby name in Amsterdam, Utrecht, Rotterdam, and The Hague is, you guessed it, Mohammed. Europeans' Muslim population doubled in the last generation and is set to double again by 2025, and that is only a decade and a half away. A third of all births in the EU will be Muslim. The demographic writing is already on the wall. A third of Muslims in France and Germany are teenagers or younger, as compared to a fifth of the native population. A third of Muslims in the UK and Belgium are under 15 versus a fifth of the native population. Now, counting all age groups, they're a minority, but in generational demographics, Muslims are swiftly becoming the majority. Now, you're looking at these numbers, and it's hard to argue that Muslims are a minority looking at them right now, guys. They are not a majority at the moment, but the majorities, it's not just a statistical snapshot, but a cultural and demographic trend. Countries are not defined by the past or even by the present, but by the future, by the direction in which they are headed. And Europe's future is a Muslim majority. Most European governments have accepted that and are acting on it. There may currently be more warm European bodies than Muslim ones, but the culture is being steered by the assumption of an Islamic future. Now, America and Canada were not nearly as vulnerable to the Muslim demographic bomb because it is less socialistic and more multicultural, although I have issues with multiculturalism. That's for another show, I think. There are also no former Muslim colonies like England or France. But the liberation of Iraq has touched off a swarm of refugees moving to the United States. While some of them are Christian, the majority are Muslim. Now, in the United States, they are obligated by law to accept 5,000 refugees a year. Now, in 2008, the target for Iraqi immigration was 12,000. That's far more than most of the former Soviet Union combined. Now, you may think these are not significant numbers, but these are part of a bigger picture, okay? In 2005, almost 100,000 Muslims became legal residents. in the United States. In 2009, it climbed to 115,000. And those numbers, they continue to rise each year. That means that already they make up around 10% of immigration to the U.S. The number of Egyptian and Syrian immigrants has more than doubled since 9/11. The number of Turkish immigrants has more than tripled. The number of Afghani has tripled. Somalis have gone up from nearly 3,000 to nearly 14,000 a year. Pakistan hit a high of 21,000 in 2009, and Saudis are up by 50%. Okay, once again, you're thinking, well, you know, not nation-shattering numbers in themselves, but think about the birth rate. The United States birth rate was 13.5. Pakistan's birth rate is 24.1. Egypt's birth rate is 24.6. The Saudi birth rate is 19.3. The Afghani birth rate is a staggering 37.3. And the Somalis are mind-boggling at 42.7. What this means is that the United States is importing Muslim immigrants with a birth rate that twice or even three times is higher than her own. Now, the United States birth rate is inflated by its own immigrants, including a large number of Latinos and the million-plus Muslims already in the United States. So guess what, guys? The baseline numbers, they get worse. Like I say, these numbers are bad enough. And take an example of the social services departments of Amsterdam or Malmo. They could tell you, the United States is not importing 115,000 Muslims a year. No. She's importing as many as 2,500 Muslim babies a year into the demographic pool. Now, let's do a little comparison. Compare that to the 25,000 Korean immigrants in 2009. These are immigrants from a country where the average birth rate is 8.5. Increase Korean immigration fivefold until they've outnumbered the annual number of Muslim immigrants, and you still aren't even importing 1,000 babies a year. 1,000 Somali immigrants are the demographic equivalent of 5,000 Korean immigrants because of the Somali birth rate is five times that of the Korean birth rate. So what this means, the 25,000 Korean immigrants represent a mere 212 babies a year, but the 14,000 Somalis represent 600 babies a year. Let me repeat that for you. 25,000 Korean immigrants represent 212 babies a year, but 14,000 Somalis represent 600 babies a year. This is demographic suicide, and it's creeping up on the nations. However, the picture is still incomplete. The Korean-American intermarriage rate is at over 50%. Now, right now, there's no stats for Somali intermarriage rates in the United States, but Muslims, they do not leave their religion upon marriage. And in Sweden and Norway, Somali intermarriage rates are very low, which means the little Mogadishus growing across the United States are not going anywhere. In given time, there will be a little Mogadishu in your city, too. I find this alarming, guys. I have studied Islamic demographics in the West. But when you sit down and you really read the numbers again and reinforce in your mind that what's going on, where are we going to be in 2025? Where will our children be, and who will they be marrying? There will be a Muslim population boom. It's going to sneak up on us, and it's going to be soon. However, Muslims are still considered a minority who must be granted special dispensation. But you got to ask yourself, are they really minorities? Because there are two kinds of minorities. There's the first kind. It comes from countries where they were a minority or they were under foreign rule. For example, the Irish, Jews, Tibetans, Armenians, and Norwegians are all examples of that. Now, the second kind of minority isn't really a minority at all. This minority immigrates from countries where they are the ruling majority. They are not persecuted and are not escaping anything except living in a failed state. That's right. These majority minorities, as they're called, are designated as minorities by political correctness. But they don't think of themselves as minorities or act like minorities. They are used to being the dominant culture, and when they are hostile, it is not because of a sense of persecution, but xenophobia. While they are labeled minorities, they actually behave like majorities, and we are seeing that. For example, the most famous example is Dearborn, Michigan. They are acting like the majority culture because in their minds, Muslims think that's what they are. Muslims in particular are majority minorities who act with all the entitlements and privileges of a majority. When Somali cabbies refuse to carry airport passengers with duty-free liquor, or almost half of Muslims in the UK want Sharia law, they are behaving as if they are already part of the majority, entitled to force their culture, their law, and their religion on the minority. And in their eyes, we are the minority, because they have no cultural tradition of how to be minorities. The Irish, the Jews, and the African Americans have a cultural memory of being persecuted that they retain in song and story. But Muslims have rushed to wipe away the shame of briefly living under European colonialism by casting back to the Golden Age when they were the oppressors, reviving the caliphate and lashing out violently at even the slightest criticism of their religion. Now, as of today, Muslims in America and Europe are still numerical minorities, but they act like majorities, and they are doing everything they can to become majorities. Treating them like minorities is a mistake that Europe has already come to regret and that we are only beginning to learn the folly of. Muslims can either be a minority or a majority. If they choose to act like a majority, imposing their culture, religion, and worldviews on others, then they should be treated like one. And I couldn't agree with that more. Like I say, that is from Sultan Nish, Daniel Greenfield. I thought you'd find that rather interesting. Now, I have something else in here I want to share with you. But I think I'm going to take a break because it's a bit of a departure from my usual. But I have a bit of news from Canada. It does involve Islam. I don't even know how to share this story, but I'll try. I'm going to take a quick break right now, and I'll be back in 2 minutes here. What have I got in here for you?
Coming.
And welcome back to the Red Fox Blogger with your host, Kel Fritzy. I want to talk to you about honor killings. We had yet another honor killing in Toronto last week. I am getting rather concerned about this. As you recall, I did a show on the Shafia mass honor killings in Canada quite a while back. I think I did it on my, I did it on my old show, the old Red Fox show. But that was, Canada had the dubious distinction of having the first mass Islamic honor killing, and that was the Shia family. That took place on June 30th of 2009 in Kingston, Ontario. There were the three sisters and the first wife. That was Zanib, who was 19, Sahar, who was 17, Gidi, who was 13, and Roma Amir Muhammad, who was 50. They're the ones who were found dead inside their car that was discovered underwater at the Kingston Mill locks of the Rodeo Canal. They were killed by their birth father and birth mother. Now, you got to remember, too, is that Rona was the first wife. Muhammad was married to Rona first, but she was barren, thus he married a Tuba, and they bore numerous children. But the kids, when they came from the Middle East, they lived in Australia first, then they moved to the United Arab Emirates, and then they moved to Canada. Mohammed, Shafia, Tuba, Yahya, and the older brother, Hamad, Shafia, murdered their three daughters and sister and the first wife because they were becoming too westernized. And we had another honor killing this week. This took place in Toronto. A Muslim man, he stabbed his wife so many times, there was no body from the waist up. Now, there is a child named Yashin Wefa who is without a mother because his mother, Nazira Fazli, who is 31, was brutally stabbed dead last week in her Ajax home, and Ajax is a borough of Toronto. Her husband, Faridun Mohammed Ibrahim, 31. He is charged with second-degree murder, and he was arrested without incident this week at the home and was remanded into custody. Nazira, she was a rock to the family. She had bought a house for her parents and siblings with whom she lived. She had been a Canadian citizen who emigrated from Afghanistan 24 years ago. She came here as a child, obtained Canadian citizenship, lived here, worked here, paid taxes here. Unfortunately, she married Ibrahim 3 years ago. She went back to Afghanistan for an arranged marriage. She returned to Canada. She gave birth to Yashin, their only child, and then she sponsored Ibrahim to join her about 4 months ago. Nazira, she was successful. She worked in customer service at American Express. She only wanted to get married and start a family. But cracks emerged. She and Ibrahim, they got their own place. Ibrahim was demanding. He was stubborn. It was always his way or the highway. In other words, this immigrant from Afghanistan could not adapt to Western values. He started to threaten Nazira, and she started to fear for her life and felt that the marriage, arranged marriage, with somebody she had otherwise known for years, turned out to be a huge mistake, and yes, she was right. So you have to understand, Nazira, she was a westernized woman with her own job and her own home. She made the mistake of marrying one of the local boys from Afghanistan and brought him to Canada, where he slaughtered her so bad she was unrecognizable. Relatives said, well, he wasn't adjusting well to life here, because back home he was a doctor, and in Canada he was nothing. Mm-hmm. But that happened in Toronto this week, in Canada. I don't know what to do about this. There are a lot of people out there who insist that Islamic immigration has got to stop. I am of the same mind, because I think I've had it with this. I do not like opening up my dailies and reading these stories and seeing this. Women being slaughtered by their male relatives. One, because they want to adapt to Canadian or American or European life. They want to be just like everybody else. In the case of the Ashafia sisters, they wanted to be like their friends. In the case of Nazira, she was already westernized. Like I say, she had lived in Canada for 24 years. She was fully integrated into Western society. But I will never understand how her roots in Islam drew her back into such a barbaric tradition as that of an arranged marriage to a man who had no idea how to assimilate into Western culture. That was her mistake. It's women like these who I try to reach out to and try to explain to them that Islam is a misogynistic religion. You are not equal under Islam. This is why I fight so hard to see Sharia law abandoned, because of stories like this and more. There are so many more stories, but these stories we read, they're sensationalistic because they happen right in our backyard. These people, these men, pretend to be westernized, pretend to adapt, but we know that to be a lie. How about the men in the business suit? The Muslims in the business suits who pretend that they just want to build bridges and they want to promote Islam as a religion of peace, tolerance, understanding, and love. I believe there was a case in the United States a few years back. As he has said, Imamazi as Hassan, they formulated Bridges TV. Do you remember that? That was in Buffalo. That was in Orchard Park near Buffalo, New York. Beautiful couple. She's dressed smartly, beautiful long hair, gorgeous, gorgeous face. He looks very dapper in his business suit. They both look very happy, very proud of their new TV site called Bridges TV. But what we didn't know behind that marriage is that Hassan was extremely abusive, extremely physically, emotionally, and mentally abusive towards Asiya. And when she tried to leave, her reward was being beheaded on the station floor of Bridges TV. This is why I do not trust Islam. This is why I do not trust Muslims. When they try to tell me that Islam is a religion of peace, I defer back to these stories, and it reinforces my belief that they will never, ever be able to escape the clutches of what Islam represents. Islam is an all-encompassing system of submission. You can't be an Islamist or even a Muslim and embrace individual democracies and freedoms. You are forced to live as a collective. After Hassan decapitated his wife in that TV station, he calmly walked to the police station and told him what he did. And he thought he was right in doing so because the wife was stepping out of line. This is a man who is trying to convince us that Islam meant no harm. Islam was a religion of peace after all. Let's all get along. Let's all sing kumbaya. Didn't quite work out that way, did it? All right, I'm going to wrap it up in about maybe 15 minutes, the stories, I mean, because I have a few public service announcements I want to make before I do close out. I've got my soft thoughts, 25 minutes left, but I want to warn you about something. Identity fraud. Yep. Identity fraud. I have a story about what's going on with Iranians. But you know what happened in Toronto last week? There was a Yonge Street shop. It was selling Canadian, it was fake. They were selling fake ID, fake Canadian, United States IDs, for as little as $60 a pop. Yeah. This store was open for business. Now, three people had been charged by Toronto police for this. They've been charged with a variety of forgery offenses. They were operating, like I say, a Yonge Street store and website that allegedly sells fake identification. They sell these fake cards for jurisdictions across North America. However, they don't sell them. Fake Ontario ID. I find that interesting. They're operating out of Ontario, but they're not selling fake Ontario ID, but they are in a lot of other jurisdictions. This business is called the ID Shack, or it was. And they try to portray the documents it produces as novelty cards. Give me a break. Now, they also said that what they were doing is that they were just trying to target young people as their customers in search of fake ID to get into the bars, buy booze. But no, they were selling all over the place, and they were selling to all demographics. And they were doing a good business. Really good business. And this stuff, it looked authentic. Unbelievably authentic. They had it down to a T. Arizona driver's licenses, Colorado driver's licenses, Delaware, Manitoba, British Columbia, Quebec. Fake ID. $60 a card? Maybe you can vote. Or you can apply for social insurance. Or you can apply for welfare benefits using these cards. But But they came under suspicion when there was a father went in. His son was telling him about this site on the internet, and the father was like, "You got to be kidding me." Son said, "No, look at this." So the father took a look at it. These cards are so, or, well, there, who knows how many are out there, right? They are so sophisticated. They had the ultraviolet printing, holograms, magnetic encoding. They had the stripe and 3D barcode, as well as advising people to send in high-quality photos to improve the look of the card. Police, they finally got a search warrant for the store, and they found a large number of identification cards from different provinces and states, as well as fake press passes and firefighter identification. In the raid, they seized a number of IDs, postal receipts, computers, and cash. Three people have been charged. And the reason why the father found out is because the ID Shack, they weren't even hiding its operation. They had a presence on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. And it described itself online as a graphic design firm based in Toronto, Canada. Fake ID. And something else here that I came across. And this is rich. You'll love this one. There is a report. Iranians in Canada, they were caught using fake Israeli passports. There was a group of seven posing as an Israeli family. They evidently sought to emigrate to Canada, but they were foiled because of the faulty Hebrew spelling. Seven Iranians caught using fake Israeli passports at the Vancouver International Airport, and this happened yesterday. The Iranians, whose identity is unknown, they were posing as a family from the central city of Rivovbot. Hang on, I'm not saying that right. Boy, oh boy. Rehobot. This is according to an Israeli news website. Now, these individuals, they sought to immigrate to Canada. And they may have been trying to take advantage of Israelis' ability to travel to Canada without a visa. Mm-hmm. Because citizens, by contrast, citizens of Iran, they need a visa to enter Canada. But look at the names and the ages of these seven. They listed their ages and names. Mona is 48. Tomar is 40. Nadine is 15. Narin is 11. Binyamin is 9. Marin is 6. And Nerman is 5. And the last name they used in the documents was Solomon. Now, the passports, however, they contained several Hebrew errors and mismatched translations, and that allowed authorities to recognize them as forgeries. The passports were then sent to Israel's Population and Immigration Authority, which confirmed that the documents were fake. This is not the first time, though. These are not the first seven. Oh, my. No, no, no. Several Iranians have in recent years tried to enter various countries with fake Israeli passports. In April, an Iranian national carrying a forced Israeli passport was arrested while loitering outside the Israeli embassy in the Nepalese capital of Kathmandu. At the time, it was not clear what his intentions were and whether he was simply a scout or was capable of actually attacking the embassy, its employees, and visitors. We all know about fake ID. We're all not naive here. We know what's going on with it, but this is just the latest in a series that's going on out there. In this day and age of technology, anything is virtually possible, pun intended. Now, maybe this Iranian family, maybe they're a really nice family, Maybe they honestly did want to get out of Iran. Maybe they were that desperate. But it makes me wonder, too, I wonder how much they paid for these fake passports. I wonder how much money the parents doled out. Now, at the ID Shack, you can get a fake driver's license for $60. But boy, oh boy, when it comes to passports, that's a whole different ball of wax. The Iranian family, of course, will be deported back to Iran. Okay, I have a few programming notes, and then I'm going to wrap it up, and I'm just looking for my other note to let you know what is going on out there. You can hear me here, as you know, on Monday afternoons at 3 p.m., and, of course, here on Fridays at 7 p.m. But I'm not the only one who discusses Islam. Nope. There is a whole radio station out there, the Radio Jihad Network, and you can hear their programs right here on Blog Talk Radio 7 days a week. And I do hope you check out these fine programs. Because on Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we have the Vito Esposito Show. On Tuesday at 11 p.m., we have the Andrew Bisad Show. On Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we have the Eliza Jane Show, and that is Freedom Quest. On Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we have the Gadi Edelman Show, American Akbar. And Friday, which is, of course, today, coming soon to Blog Talk Radio near you, is the Lisa Marie Johnson Show, and her time slot is yet to be announced. On Saturday at 10 p.m. Eastern Time, we have Usama Dakdok, and that is Revealing the Truth About Islam. And on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, we have the Uncle Dave Show. So try to tune in to Radio Jihad Network, please. I'm kind of doing the de facto Friday show for them. I don't mind doing it at all. I also want to share something else with you, and that is a new show, and that is The Cross in the Desert, and that is with host Randy L. Noble, critically acclaimed author. Randy L. Noble is a Christian. He works with Christian Iranians. He talks with a lot of people in Iran. He will be. He has already had his own show right here on Red Fox Blog or IAW. You can look for that on my homepage. But he will be back for another program on August 4th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. I hope you check him out. Just going to give you a little bit. This is a bit of music from his opening song. You get an idea. This man is a Christian. He's a good man. He's a brilliant orator. I'm very proud to have him on board, Red Fox Blogger.
Healing rain is coming down.
Wanted to play a little bit of some of the music that you can enjoy. He's like I say, he's a very good Christian man. He helps Iranians. He works with a lot of Christians in Iran. He would be considered an apostate as well. This is why I'm proud to have him as my friend and proud that he will be doing his own shows here on the Red Fox Blogger, IAW. His next show, August 4th. At 8 p.m. Eastern Time. This man is unbelievable. He knows so much. He's a great writer as well. Now, I am out of here. I know it's a few minutes early, but I guess what? I ran out of stories. I usually get a caller on Friday night or three. Sometimes I can have up to six people on the switchboard, but I was all alone tonight, baby. So you know what? I'm just going to wrap it up 10 minutes. Well, you know what? Probably more like 5 minutes early because the truth is, guys, is that I never really shut up, but I don't want to ramble on and get you totally bored with me. You come here to listen to things that you do not hear in the mainstream media, and people like me and people like the folks at the Radio Jihad Network, that's what they try to do too. This is also why we have our blogs out there that you can read and you can share, because you are not going to hear even a tip of the iceberg of the truth of what Islam is in your national dailies. You might get a little short story, man murders wife under arrest, but if you go to blogs like Creeping Sharia or Bare Naked Islam, you're going to get the full story about what that man was, what a monster he was. You're going to find out he was an Islamist, and he beheaded his wife in a fit of honor rage. That's all we try to do. We give you the stories, we make you think, and we hope that you pass them along. If I can educate one person, my work is done. I'm proud to do it. I'm proud that you listen to me, because it's because of you that I do what I do, and I do it with enthusiasm, passion, and love. There are lives out there that can be saved, that can be touched, that can be changed, and we can all, as a collective, all together, we can battle this scourge called Islam. I also want to remind you guys it's Friday. For my Canadian friends, please make sure you're wearing your Red for Our Troops. And for my American friends, please make sure you're wearing your Benghazi black for Friday. For me, I'm wearing both red and black because I remember all our troops, not just our Canadian troops, all our allied forces. And I will never, ever let Benghazi go. I wear black for Benghazi until justice is done. On that note, I am out of here. Guys, thank you very much for joining me. I will see you on Monday afternoon at 3 p.m. Have a wonderful weekend.